You're listening to KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara, and this is Sustainable World. And on today's show, I'm Jill Cloutier, the host, and Suzanne Cloutier is out and about in the studio right now. On today's show, we're joined in the studio with permaculturist Jenny Pell. Welcome to Sustainable World, Jenny.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Jenny, to introduce you could take quite a bit of time. I was reading about you on the internet, and you've done so much and are involved in so many projects, and I hope today we're going to get to hear about a lot of your projects. But Jenny has a very fascinating history. Currently, she's president of the Wilder Institute Next Generation Permaculture. She's a permaculture designer who's doing work in the Pacific Northwest, Central America, and Hawaii. Jenny's latest project was in Nicaragua, teaching a hands-on design intensive for single mothers and children. And Jenny, you've also started a permaculture all-stars edible plant nursery and horticultural workshop series in her hometown of Port Townsend, Washington. So, Jenny, let's start with, from all the information I got on the internet, it seems that you've had a lot of careers. Tree planter, helicopter pilot, carpenter. You were president of a yurt company that actually sold yurts to Mongolia. Is that true?
Yeah.
An entrepreneur and social agitator. And I don't know if I missed any of your careers. And, oh, you did have a trucking license as well.
Yeah. I used to have a trucking license.
You did. How did you find your way to permaculture? And was it one of the only things that you hadn't done?
Oh, that's a funny question. Yeah. I was working as a tree planter up in the bush of British Columbia. Did a couple seasons in the Rockies, and then I did two seasons living on a boat on the Inside Passage from the coast up to Alaska, planting trees there. And that's where I met my first permaculture people, living on homesteads out in the bush, and I was really impressed with them personally and also that their homesteads looked like. And since then, and started studying permaculture and going to their workshops and basically, you know, tapping into that whole lifestyle. That time, that was about 20 years ago.
Wow. So you've been involved with permaculture for quite a long time. Now, maybe before we get into a discussion about your projects that you're working on, I'm wondering if you could give our listeners a definition of what permaculture is. I know that's kind of a loaded question.
Yeah, sure. Well, permaculture is the words permanent agriculture put together, which we hope in time leads to permanent culture. And it was the word was coined by a man named Bill Mollison some 30 years ago and his student David Holmgren. And it since has developed into a thriving international grassroots movement for designing sustainable human community. And I know that might sound trite, but really what we do as permaculturalists is we look at all the design sciences that are going to allow us as humans to live and thrive in an area, which it will include food production, water systems, natural building, maybe passive solar using local materials, and human wastes and all kinds of things like that, so that we actually become active and integral parts of the web of life where we live. So permaculture, it's a design method. So very clearly we look at flows through the land and access and winds and fire and water and all the things that are there that we have to analyze before we can do a proper design.
That have impact.
That have impact. Yeah. And another thing that we do is we look at analog climates around the world. So as I live in the Pacific Northwest, an analog climate for me would be southern Chile. And we see what grows there and what systems work there. And we try to use other designs from other communities in similar climates for stronger systems.
That's interesting. Now, I know that in an article written about you online, you stated that permaculture is, quote, a harmonious integration of people into the landscape in such a way that the land grows in richness, productivity, and aesthetic beauty. Now, I'm wondering, I've always thought that humans have a predominantly negative impact on their surroundings. Is this really possible for people to live in, quote, in harmony with the land?
Well, what's been one of the interesting things I've learned recently is that, for example, when you think of the Amazon basin and you have a lot of indigenous people living in the woods there, it turns out that those people have been stewarding that land over many, 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 many hundreds of years. And so it's not just a wild rainforest with this little tiny human enclave living inside it. Actually, the humans that live there have developed into a very symbiotic relationship with that environment. They've also learned that when the white people first landed on the East Coast, they came to these lands and they thought, oh, how beautiful park-like it is here. Well, it turned out the indigenous people on the coasts there were also doing the same thing. They had vast areas that they, farmed is the wrong word, but that they had a relationship with, where they, cut trees and where they hunted animals and where they farmed and gleaned off that landscape, but actually they were part of that landscape in a very integral way.
Interesting. So they were a part of it without destroying it.
Yeah, it is actually possible.
Mm-hmm. That's hopeful.
Yeah.
Hopeful for the future. Now, so you gave an example of people in the Amazon. What about, is urban permaculture, does that exist? Or do you have to have a big homestead? Do you have to be out in the country to do permaculture?
As you know, permaculture, more than anything, is about people and place. And in that design methodology, you know, if I'm going to design a project for anybody, I do an extensive client interview. So if they're an urban person, I'm clearly designing for an urban landscape. And if it's a person who lives way out in the middle of nowhere and has 75 acres, that's a completely other design. I think urban permaculture is probably some of the most exciting permaculture going on. There's an enormous amount of resources of people and talent and skills, and there's also infrastructure. There's also physical resources that are there. There's rooftop gardens. There's, you know, trellised walls. There's city pea patches. Up in Seattle, where I live, some of the best urban permaculture is being done by Asian immigrants because they have this great tradition of growing food, and these little small community gardens spring up that are just incredibly intensive food growing areas.
Mm, interesting. Now, someone asked me when I told them that I'm actually in a permaculture course right now, and they said, well, isn't permaculture just based on the old ways of doing things, like the ancient models, you know, that indigenous people have been doing for years? Would you say that's true? Or
I say that's partly true. Tapping into indigenous knowledge is critical for survival of the human family, in my opinion. But what I love about permaculture is it really marries the best of all the sciences. So we take, you know, we seek out, very actively seek out indigenous knowledge, lore, storytelling, definitely included in that. And we marry it with the best of the hard sciences. Some of what we've learned in the organic agriculture movement in recent decades has been very important to that. So I'd say it's an integration of several different disciplines. Some of it is very modern, and some of it is, you know, clearly looking to successful traditions in the past, going back to indigenous peoples.
So it's almost like an all-encompassing, like taking the best from the ancient ways and then maybe taking the best of appropriate technology?
Yeah.
Would you say? Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I also say, you know, in permaculture, we don't necessarily pretend to invent anything. That's not what we're about. You know, we are looking for this synthesis for holistic design. And what we've learned is that as designers, one thing we can do is really figure out what's the minimum number of elements we can put in relative locations so that they create synergy. Once you have this synergy, then you have this sort of, you know, movement in the area that brings in, you know, water and birds and insects and humans are attracted to go hang out there, and pollinators. And so you get this, you know, this incredible movement in the landscape that way.
Now, is I noticed too, it seems like I've been aware of permaculture probably for 15 years, 10 to 15 years, but it seems like lately I've been hearing a lot about it in the news and in magazines. Do you think that permaculture's time has come, and that, why do you think it's especially important at this time?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Permaculture is a thriving international movement, there's no doubt about it. Permaculture is being taught and practiced in every country on the planet, in some places more than others. I work a lot in the tropics and in Central America, and permacultura, as we call it, people are really taking up the mantle there, I think partly because it's so much more relevant to people's lives. You know, people live in much more farming, they're much closer to the land, and when you come in and say, no, we built a pond here, you could also have fish, and you could have these types of trees that overhang, and people are like, well, let's do it. They're ready just to take action and jump in and do it.
Maybe not so many laws and regulations.
Also not so many. They're not going to do like 18 environmental impact studies. They're like, let's grow some food. So, you know, in terms of its, you know, its timeliness, absolutely. There are certain countries in the world now that are taking up permaculture as its design methodology. In Vietnam, for example, the Ministry of Agriculture is starting to develop permaculture ag strategies for its country. There's a couple of countries in Africa doing the same thing. So timeliness, absolutely. I think, you know, for me personally, I say this often, my peak oilometer is pegged, and I'm looking into an energy descent culture, is a permaculture term, and what does that look like as we start to learn how to localize our economies and can't have our food coming from 2,000 miles away. And, so, you know, for me, it's a lot about building community, building local strategies, having in our community those skills necessary for localizing and being self-sufficient.
Now, that I went and heard your lecture last night. It was incredible. My friend and I talked about it the whole way home. How we were really inspired by it and challenged by parts, because I feel that you really just came out and spoke from your heart. And it was great. It raised discussion. My niece and I were talking a lot about it. We were saying that it was so cool to see a woman on stage just empowered. So it was really great. But one question I had for you, I noticed you stressed a lot about skill building. And one of the things that you said was, what repository of knowledge do you want to possess? And that really struck me. And that kind of leads into the peak oil question. Do you feel that our lives will be impacted by peak oil? And how does this tie into skill building?
I think our lives are already impacted by peak oil. I mean, if you don't see that, I would challenge you to pay a little bit more attention to that equation. Skill building for me is, it's about part of designing human community so that it's a really great place for us to live and to thrive there. Involves a lot of creativity to satisfy that just undying human curiosity. And so you have to design into your human systems stuff that satisfies that edge, you know? And so the skill building part of it is, if you need food production, this is an easy one. So what kind of skills do you need there? Well, you need to be able to collect seed and plant seed and propagate things, and you need to work in the orchard and prune everything and harvest it. You need to, preserve it, and you need to learn how to prepare it and cook it. And so there's all those skills involved with that. You know, bamboo is a great one in the tropics. You know, bamboo you can use for everything. You can eat it, you can build with it, you can make chopsticks out of it, you can make walls, you can make furniture. It's an incredible plant. And so when you have in your community a whole bunch of different people that have these skills, they're interesting, skilled people in your community. Just like if you have a pond builder or if you have somebody who's involved in aquatic plants, they're intimately connected with that plant life. And that's an interesting person to have in your community. In my town, we have a luthier. He builds instruments. And so he's always looking for great wood and those types of things.
Now, one thing you said, I think you are in one of your projects, which we'll start talking about soon, up in Washington. You're developing curriculum for teaching, I think, high school, is it, or college students as well. And you were talking about how some college students came after 15 years of school or however many years they've been in, and they realized they hadn't really learned anything practical.
We do several different teaching methods. We do a 2 to 3 week design courses all over the world. I think we offer 4 or 5 a year in all in different places. I'll be teaching this year in Mexico, Nicaragua. We'll be doing a course in Hawaii, the Bahamas. I'm actually working in Portugal this year, also in the Pacific Northwest. And we recruit a whole range of ages into our courses. There is almost always a moment with our younger students in their mid-20s where there's literally a fist-slamming anger moment where they've just had their eyes and ears and minds open to what the permaculture paradigm is, and they realize that they've had incredible amounts of education, but they actually don't know how to do anything. They don't know how to plant a seed. They don't know how to fix the irrigation system. They don't know how to. They don't know how to use a hammer. They don't know how to build anything, and they feel duped. And they also
it's
feel
worse
like
when you're in your 40s.
That's my answer. I say, at least you're not 50 and figuring this out. But it is a challenging moment where I could make people angrier in that moment and say, what about this? But instead, what I choose to do is channel that into, now you know, and what really turns you on here? Like, what repository of knowledge would you like to become? I really ask them at that moment, of all the things you've seen so far, is there something that really, really turns you on? And if there is, I will network you up the line to people that are doing this work somewhere else and encourage you to go study with them.
That's been, I know too that Larry Santoyo, who's a permaculture teacher in this area, said that he had a dream where the powers that be came to all the people that, all of us, and said, okay, it's your turn, rule the world, do what you, go ahead, do all these things you're saying you're going to do. And he thought, oh my gosh, are we ready? Am I ready? And I think it's so easy, because I know my friend and I were going to meetings in town, and people are saying, yes, when peak oil comes, we're going to have to, grow our own food and all this. And 1 out of 6 people in the room were growing their own food. No one knew. People don't know how to do it, but it's so easy to talk about it.
Yeah.
How great it'll be when we do all of this stuff.
Yeah. Growing food is actually, to me, it's a joy. And one of the things that I work on a lot of ag statistics, I do a lot of agricultural stuff in my county. And, often in our towns, smaller towns, less than 1% of what we eat is grown locally. That's scary to me. You look at, oil at $2 a gallon. Okay, well, we can afford to import it from 2,000 miles away. But what if gas is $5 a gallon? Every single, point of distribution there will cost more money, including the plastic container that it comes in, which is made from petroleum. Mm-hmm. So growing food to me is a way to, have a relationship with the earth, get outdoors, be healthy, know your neighbors, have a surplus, share it, cook meals, sit down at the table with your friends and family, which is where you're starting to weave that web of community and family connection. That's a key part of moving forward in this interconnected web of community and belonging and place and having a relationship to place.
And I loved what you said last night, too, about community is not getting, it's not being around people that you completely jive with and get along with. It's actually getting along with people that you're very different from.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, when I surround myself with people that are really like-minded, I get bored, actually. It's not, there's not the diversity of thought there. And it doesn't inspire you to look at solutions either. It just, you don't get creative in your solutions. So community to me is living with people that are very different and figuring out how to get along and with very common baselines. You know, I have some limits. You know, I don't want my neighbors putting poisons on the ground. I don't. Mm-hmm. And I will challenge people to find different ways to do that. Mm-hmm. And you can get rid of weeds and the cracks in your sidewalk with a pot of boiling water. You don't need to put a chemical down there.
I should tell my neighbor about that.
Yeah.
He's like the spraying king. It's not good. Now, I note this, just to get back to skill sharing, you were talking about intergenerational skill sharing, and that seemed like you thought that was really important. And could you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah. One of the things in permaculture we teach is to seek out elders and tap them for the knowledge that they have. What I find a lot with our elders in our communities is that they're often neglected, and they do have a lot of information that would really, really great for us to learn. And many times our children aren't interested, particularly if you have a farmer. We often do these city analyses in some of our urban stuff where we walk down alleys. And if we see a backyard that's got tons of stuff in it, and one of my colleagues can tell a Philippine person from 50 paces. Like, they're like, oh, let's go to that yard over there. There's got to be a Filipino man that lives there. And sure enough, there's an older Filipino person, and you sort of knock on the gate, and they're in their backyard and say, wow, what a beautiful yard you have. Oh, can I come help you clean it up? And you mm-hmm. walk away with five kinds of plants, and you come back a week later, and you start to develop a relationship mm-hmm. with them.
What a great learning experience.
Yeah, and I find when I work with elders or older people in the community, they're in what I call the legacy phase of their life. They have information. They have knowledge. They want to share it. They have nobody to talk to share it with. And for us as younger people, I think our culture has taught us that older people don't have anything to teach us. That's you're missing something critical at a juncture of our human family where we every skill and every bit of knowledge and every bit of lore and every story is relevant to the survivability of our species. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of fun with the elders. We recently did a grafting workshop where we penetrated into the fruit club. We've infiltrated. Average age in the fruit club is about 75. We showed up with 8 farm interns around the age of 20 and really sat at the feet of these grafting masters. Mm-hmm. And it was the young folks loved it. They learned so much. They were so grateful. The old folks were just tickled to be asked. And they were really, really pleased to pass our skills on.
That's wonderful. Because there, I know when I used to work part-time, I would go in and do a little bit of yoga in a old folks home. And they were so brimming over with knowledge. Like you say, they really want to talk. And I don't think there's any outlet for that.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you get these programs going where you would actually seek out older people? Was it just like you said about the garden, but what about the club or just kind of?
Well, okay. When I first started working in permaculture, one of my colleagues who I respect greatly, his name is Douglas Bullock, and he teaches that, look for elders. And I had another friend who was getting into forging, doing metal work, and a friend said, there's a guy there's an old man down the road who used to do forging. I think he's got some tools. If you want to, maybe you could just go knock on his door. Well, he kind of got up his gumption and went down and knocked on the door and said, I'm kind of interested in starting this. I really want to do it. And the old man took him out and opened the doors to his garage. It was just full of cobwebs, and there was an entire forging shop there.
Wow.
And he said, I will teach you anything you want to know, and if you really get into it, you can have all these tools. Mm-hmm. And that was that's the kind of thing where here you have this stuff gathering dust, mm-hmm. and how do we get it back into the neighborhood? Mm-hmm. In the tropics, people there do have great respect for their elders, and in the village sense. And I do a lot of work, periodically with indigenous villages, and there is a whole different level of respect and storytelling tradition where you pass the knowledge down the line, which has been interrupted by Western culture infiltrating into those areas too.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know last night you were speaking about indigenizing yourself to the place, and I know in one of the articles I read you said the place where you land. What does that mean exactly?
Well, Aboriginal people We're the first people to live in any place. So if you're Aboriginal, you're the first humans that landed there and stayed there and became part of that landscape. The Indigenous people are whoever came after that and then stayed and learned the ways of that place. In our culture, we move around a lot. We have very transient cultures, and a lot of people remove themselves from the web of life in the place that they are because I'm not going to be here very long. Oh, I'm just renting, so why would I bother? And I'm not going to put any value added into this property because why should the landlord benefit and forget? I'm not going to waste my time. And you know, I think that it doesn't matter if you're there for a week or if you're there for 2 years. Mm-hmm. How can you in that moment observe what's going on and see where the water flows and see what fruit grows there, or help somebody in their backyard, or become just decide in that moment that you're going to participate in an indoor-outdoor relationship with that land and that flow of energy of people or water or whatever's happening in that spot. I was telling this to someone last night, I have planted more people's gardens and more orchards and more fruit trees for, I'm never going to eat any of that stuff. This is what I do. One day I'll have my own land and I'll be able to stay and eat the fruits of my own labor. But actually, you know what? It's a joy for me. I delight in the fact that somebody's going to have fruit dripping, you know, juice dripping down their chin from a tree that I planted, and that they won't even know who I am. You know, I delight in that. And when I, you know, pick a fruit off a tree and I eat it, I might take a moment to be grateful for the person who planted it. Mm-hmm. And that's that kind of, you know, it's a different sense of yourself in that forging of a future.
Well, it's a true giving because you're giving without even seeing the benefits of what, you see the immediate benefits, but then people along the line are going to be grateful toward you for planting that tree.
Yeah, but if you see yourself part of a, you know, seven generations, or if you see yourself mm-hmm. as related to every future generation that's coming, you're feeding future generations. What? Why would you not want to do that?
Because we think we're only going to be there for a few months. I mean, it's kind of that mindset. But basically, I think maybe part of what you're saying is just treat where you are right now as your home and with respect, and as if you're going to be there for a while, or not even if you're going to be there, but someone's going to be there.
Yeah. Someone's going to be there. And this is a challenge for me in Western culture, is that the entire culture has a pervasive sense of that there's not enough. Mm-hmm. And there's it's a poverty mindset, even though this is the most abundant culture ever in the history of mankind. And everybody here has enough water and enough food and shelter. I mean, even people who are struggling and homeless still are well fed compared to most people in the world. And so for me, that sense of abundance is a utter mindset, and it's an utter way of participating in your landscape and in your community.
And it's also thinking what you were saying. It's we're all connected, and it's thinking beyond ourselves. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah. And when I went to a workshop once, and a woman, taught us that, Americans wake up in the morning and they say, oh, I didn't get enough sleep, and I don't have enough time to make any breakfast, so I have to go to the fast food place and eat 6 plastic containers for my breakfast. And oh, I got to work, and I didn't get enough done at work today, and I definitely don't have enough time to make dinner for my kids, and I don't have enough time. And then they go to bed at night, and they didn't get enough work done.
It's always not enough.
And that it's just pervasive in the culture.
Which is so interesting with so much abundance around us.
Yeah, and so people fill that void with, cash therapy, or they buy things, and it's a very empty feeling in the end. And, I definitely discourage people, one, from thinking that way, and two, from shifting their lives so that they don't have those pressures.
Well, like you were saying last night, you were for the 4-day work week.
Yeah, I would much rather make 20% less money and work 20% less time and have 20% more time to grow food or be in my community, be with my family.
And like we were saying, you walk down the street, at least in our neighborhood, and there's all these front porches with little chairs and couches on them. I see one man sits on his front porch out of 4 blocks.
Yeah.
He's there consistently.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm a musician. I also, sit on my doorstep and play music. And I also plant food, not in my backyard, but in my front yard. And so when people walk by, there's an interactive element there. Mm-hmm. And it's more lively, when you are outdoors, and that attracts people to your place.
Yes, and the food too, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I would love for you just to go over briefly, if you would like, is about the permaculture ethics. And I think there's 3, right?
Yeah. Okay. So the permaculture ethics are to care for the earth, and that is number one. And can you, in your everyday decisions, do things that don't damage the planet? And I give really classic examples of a cup of coffee. You know, if you're not buying organic coffee, you're supporting, you know, basically slave wages and lots of chemicals and a relatively barren landscape. And if you're buying it in a paper cup with a plastic lid, that's landfill. You're also supporting, you know, dioxins and bleached paper. And, you know, so can you just in really, really basic everyday decisions be aware of the fact of whether or not you're caring for the earth in that moment? Now, the second ethic is to care for people. And if you don't care for people, they're going to take care of themselves. They have families to feed. They have mortgages to pay. They have things to do, and they will look out for themselves. And so in our designing for human community, we really design to take care of the people that are there. We have a funny story. It's like, you know, you design so that there's a place with sun, and it's bright, and it's inviting. And, you know, you don't build your house on the north side of a rock, you know. And,
in the,
you know,
dank dark.
In the dank dark where you, you know, become an alcoholic and get divorced. You know, it's like, you know, you design for what's going to make you thrive as a person and as a community. And the third ethic is to distribute and share the surplus. And sometimes your surplus is zucchini, is my favorite example, and sometimes your surplus is knowledge. And in my town of Port Townsend, we have an enormous amount of talent in our town, and not hardly any jobs. And so creating a design institute where people can, as part of their work, teach and share their skills, what we're exporting from our community is knowledge. We have a lot of it, and that's what we need to get those skills and that knowledge out into the community. So sometimes your surplus is water, sometimes your surplus is food, sometimes your surplus is energy. You know, in my state, I don't know what you do here, but if you have solar panels and you tie back into the grid, the state is obligated to buy any energy that you produce. Mm-hmm. And your meter actually runs backwards. So
so that surplus can be, it can be in any area of surplus, your skills, your talents, what you're growing, energy.
Yep.
And I noticed last night you gave a challenge for one day. You just said, see if for one day you cannot harm the earth. And that was the permaculture ethic, care for the earth. And I thought, I don't know. I don't think I could because of my clothes.
Yeah.
You know, well, it's just like everything. I thought, well, I could sit home, but then I'd be wearing clothes that were, I usually buy cotton, but then the cotton's heavily sprayed.
Yeah. So. Well, even this morning when I was coming to sit here, I was like, oh, I need a glass of water. And I said, just don't buy me a water in a plastic bottle. But instead it came in a styrofoam cup with a plastic lid and plastic straw. So, you know, even...
It's the plastic. It's everywhere.
The plastic everywhere. You know, in my town, we have a ban on styrofoam. There's no styrofoam in my town, period. Mm-hmm. That's it. It's just as you have a democratic voice. This is what democracy is about. You get to exercise it. Mm-hmm. And as a community, you can decide not to have these things.
And I think a lot of people don't, they're not aware of the effects of plastic just on the environment and also on our bodies.
Yeah.
Because plastic bottles, I've read the figure of how many plastic bottles are sold in California of water. It's staggering.
Well,
every day.
Yeah. That's a shocking equation for me. I mean, you can drink out of the tap here. You can also, you know, and I know how to build my own water filter, but, you know, filtering water is not that hard to do. For me, it's a shocking and frightening example of, you know, privatization of water and corporate control of that and incredible amounts of pollution in the production of the plastic bottles and in the landfill that they create.
And even in the recycling.
I just don't get it. I mean, I do not understand how people can go to the store and buy a case of plastic water bottles. That's just beyond me.
I know. My friend, that's her water supply. A huge case of plastic bottles for probably the past 11 years I've known her.
Yeah.
That's so many water bottles a month, but it's a challenge. Maybe let's take a short music break and then we'll come right back. I'm going to play a song by Kehilihi Rochelle called Kava Puna Hele. We'll be right back. You're listening to Sustainable World on KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara and streaming online at kcsb.org.
Ole,
Kaylee Rochelle, and you're tuned in to Sustainable World on KCSB 91.9 FM. And today our guest in studio is Jenny Pell, a permaculturist from Washington State. And Jenny, I have like this massive list of things I want to talk to you about, but because it's so inspiring to me to talk to you today. And maybe what we should do is just to make sure we fit this in is, could you tell our listeners about some of the projects that you're working on right now?
Yeah, I'd love to. Up in Washington State, I live in a small town of about 10,000 people. And like I said earlier, you know, 1% of the food that we, that we eat is grown in our county. So I'm working on a really, we're working countywide an ag strategy to how do we increase that number, you know, fivefold, tenfold, twentyfold. You know, I work with a local self-sufficiency initiative called Local 2020. And, you know, for me, it's like, what would it take for us to be growing 20% of our food by 2020? You know, how would that do that? And a lot of people are wringing their hands and saying, well, we need more farmers. We got the land is so expensive, and how are we going to attract young people? How are we going to get young farmers in here? Nobody wants to farm anymore. And I think it's really important to have more farmers in your community. I support that. But actually, I think the quickest and most effective way to increase food production is to grow your own. And it doesn't mean you have to be out in the garden slaving, you know, growing salad greens every day. But, you know, I really believe in perennials. You know, annuals are things you plant every year, like lettuce and carrots and beets. And perennials are things that bear food year after year after year, definitely with some interaction from you, but with much, much less work. So we started a Permaculture All-Stars Edible Plant Nursery.
I love that name.
And
so great.
What we did was we just researched all the best and most delicious and disease-resistant and hardy plants for our bioregion. And certainly I would say that my town is going to be somewhat of a guinea pig in this. But we have, you know, everything from mulberries and sea berries and currants and nut trees and a lot of perennial vegetables. And a perennial vegetable is asparagus or artichoke, and several examples of that. There's several Peruvian edible perennials. So we are trying to develop strategies to get food into neighborhoods. So we're offering I call it fruits for neighborhood nuts, or nuts for neighborhood fruits, special. So neighbors can get together as a group and buy $500 worth of plants. So if it's 10 families, they'd each put in $50. And then we would deliver at no cost and help install, do a little quick design charrette and help install them, not in anybody's backyard, but actually on the street. So often there's where you park, and then there's a median strip. And in my town, and certainly all over my state, I think that's public property. And I think normally towns have rules about what you can and can't plant there.
Yeah.
But for me, this is sort of a civil disobedience moment where we can just jump in and say, well, we're as a neighborhood choosing that we want to grow more food. And so we can put in fruit trees and nut trees and berry bushes and all kinds of things.
What
and
we'll a do, subversive act, Jenny.
Yeah, and then we also graft
and
trees.
Nuts.
Yeah, fruits and nuts. And then grafting is another great strategy where you have a lot of ornamental trees that you can, like a plum is a good example, is beautiful streets of ornamental plums. You could graft them over to all kinds of stone fruits, plums and peaches and nectarines and apricots. And then in a couple years have this huge yield of fruit in your neighborhood.
Now, is this what you were talking about last night, the gorilla grafting?
Well, gorilla grafting is something that, you know, we don't advertise too much, but a lot of our students get really into the graft. Grafting is a really fun, not that hard to learn, but it's a really great skill to have.
Could you explain, in case someone's tuning in and saying, what is grafting?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Grafting. Pretty much every fruit that you've eaten from the store, apples, citrus, pears, they come from grafted fruit trees. And what that means is that fruit doesn't grow true to seed. So if you took the delicious, delicious apple that you love and you cut it in half and use those 5 seeds on the inside and you planted those seeds, they would not grow. They would be mostly always be a little hard, tiny, sour crab apple. They wouldn't be anything remotely like the fruit that you ate. You know, maybe 1 in 1,000 of those seeds would grow to be a yummy fruit. And that's how we have the varieties we have now, is that people plant thousands and thousands and thousands of them, and then, there's one delicious one, and they wanted to reproduce it. So what they do is they take a branch or a certain type of what we call scion wood, a certain fresh growth that comes on the tree, and in a certain methodology, you cut it off, and you actually attach it to the rootstock or to a different root of another tree in the same family.
So almost like taking a cutting, because I do a lot of cuttings, but you're actually attaching the cutting to a tree that's already established.
Yes. Yeah. So just like, you know, you are different than your parent, you know, so just like the seed will be different from its parent fruit.
So that kind of implies that humans, in this case, that we have an important role to play in food production, which we do, obviously, but just that to make an edible, yummy fruit, we're needed to do the grafting.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the original apple came from Kazakhstan, and I don't think it's very much like the apples we eat now. But yeah, grafting is an ancient skill. It goes back to Roman times, maybe, you know, 2,000 years ago. And it's a skill people have had in the tropics. It's a skill people have all over the world. Mm-hmm. And we do it with nut trees and fruit trees and citrus trees and all kinds of things. You know, and an example of grafting is a lot of people try to grow kiwis. Where I live, kiwis are really hardy and they grow like crazy. But if you have the female but you don't have the male, and then the female is this big, gigantic plant that's, you know, vined up around this huge trellis, and then you have no male. You can actually graft the male onto the female plant and then get production right away.
Wow. Wow. Are there any plants or trees that are inappropriate for grafting that it doesn't?
they're all different, and there's amazing amounts of literature on grafting online and in your libraries. For example, hawthorn trees, I don't know if you have them here, but hawthorn trees they're often a beautiful landscaped city plant. Hawthorn trees you can graft pears onto. And we often, in orchard strategy, you know, hawthorn's really thorny on one side, and so we'll leave the thorny side facing outward where the deer are, and then we'll graft the branches on the inside of the fruits that we like.
Oh, interesting. Wow. So we can get back to nuts for neighborhoods or fruits for neighborhood nuts. Because so basically you're going to be going into neighborhoods and helping them grow their own food, basically.
Yeah, and we're actually drawing from a model that the United States developed in the 1940s when we were at war. And we had this whole Victory Garden thing that happened. And the U.S. government stepped up and said, you know, do your part to be more self-sufficient. Do your part to not use resources. Do your part to, support our troops overseas by being independent, self-sufficient, and not depending on these resources coming into your community. Mm-hmm. Be self-sufficient in your communities. And the byproduct of that is that you know your neighbors and you're healthy and you're outdoors and you're growing food and you have the skills and you used to be able to get seeds for your food stamps. That's pretty neat, you know.
Interesting.
So we're looking at this, you know, renaming the Victory Garden, you know, Freedom Gardens or Independence Gardens and starting to create a resource of that. But, you know, my goal this year is in my community to do, you know, between 10 and 15 neighborhood installations. Mm-hmm. And if I did that every year, you know, for 5 years running, you know, that's a lot of food in a really short amount of time. And I think people are really, actually, I know this in my town, people are really hungry for it. They're ready for it. They're excited about it.
That's what I was just going to ask you. What's the reception been?
It's nothing but utter enthusiasm and positive. It's like, oh, the Girl Scouts, so can we do one at our Girl Scout, you know, area? Oh, how about if we did one here? And we actually have a job in our town, which is, you know, this is a whole tree position in our town, and we're trying to actually get those people to get on board with this project. But it's also, there's a lot of mapping involved in that. So we're also mapping the kids' paths, and where the sort of, you know, sneaky little paths that people hang out, and can we put really yummy berry bushes or different kinds of climbing berries down there? And so that there's just this habit of just stopping and grazing as you go, which lets you pause and have a moment to just be in that space and appreciate it and see the bee that's there and be a part of your and interact with your outdoors.
And instead of a vending machine, stopping by the vending machine or Coke machine, you're actually going to be eating healthy, fresh fruit and food.
Yeah. I travel around to different permaculture farms around the world, and I'll tell you, the way that you know which fruit is ripe is you look at the little kids, what colors on their face.
And what color their teeth are.
Yeah, you know, so the kids always know where the fresh, ripe fruit is, and because they go down there in the berry patch, they're up in the apricot tree, like stuffing their faces, and, you know.
Yes, I know when I was in college here at UCSB, I hung out with all the organic gardeners and kind of alternative people, and there was a map that would circulate around. It was all the fruit trees and edibles in Isla Vista.
Yeah.
It was great. The mulberry tree, we'd always go, and the loquats.
Yep.
And
yeah, mapping is a great skill. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think we have to get away from language like alternative people, and I would challenge people that. And I heard Carolyn Casey speak not long ago, and it's like, we're not the left, we're not the radical left, we're not the alternative, you know, we're the sane, reverent people. You know, that's can you start your conversations with, you know, oh, I was hanging out with these really sane, reverent people, and they were showing me how to grow food, and it was really great, and I learned a lot. Instead of saying, oh, I was with these really radical, you know, alternative hippies, you know, it's like, no, we're people that are paying attention to equations that are making it, you know, abundant for all of our human family, not just for us. And we're also looking at, you know, plasticizers and all these, you know, containers that we buy our food in, and how that affects the health of ourselves and our planet. And you know, we're saying no to things. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of, you know, talk about reuse, recycle, you know, all the three R's. You know, for me, the first one is to refuse. You know, just don't buy it if it's toxic. You know, can you make that choice to, you know, that's your first choice. You know, every dollar you spend is a vote for that future. So if you can actually refuse to not buy
it, that's great.
Then you're taking a huge step into a more sane and reverent future.
That sounds wonderful. I love refuse. I'm adding that to my new. It's what I do. I, for years, like, I was so aware of this. Of when I'd go into shop, it was a painful experience for a while there, because I would like, oh, I really want this, but the plastic. It was in like plastic in plastic.
Yeah.
So I had to cut out a lot of what I was buying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's healthy.
Yeah.
It is healthy. And I promote a lot of buy local. I'm sure there's a buy local campaign in your town, but we're really, really excited about buy local and the multiplier effect it has in the economy. You know, mm-hmm. we're certainly for thriving economy. We want to have really healthy, wealthy people. I just challenge you to think about how you define profit. You know, I think I'm going to write a book called False Profit. You know, it's like money does not, doesn't make your community thrive. Oftentimes, the money in your community leaves your community. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're shopping at Safeway, you know, that money doesn't stay in your community. If you're shopping the local co-op, it does. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Our co-op is not pure. I mean, we did an analysis of packaging in the co-op, and it's pretty bleak. Yeah. And, you know, if you really make a decision, for example, I'm not going to buy things in plastic packages, well, okay, that limits your buying choices, but it also frees you enormously from participating in that garbage stream or
perpetuating
that. Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's a liberating thing to make mm-hmm. choices like that.
Except the problem I have most is on the road and the plastic water bottles. It is so hard to find anything in glass. Yeah.
You can drink from the tap here. Yeah. You know, this is not the third world. This is not a developing nation where you're going to get, you know, amoebic dysentery if you drink water out of the tap. And, you know, you can also buy a water filter for $50, and they're incredible, and they're really easy to use if you really don't want to drink tap water. But I think that buying water in plastic bottles is horrible.
And oftentimes you're supporting Coca-Cola.
Well, you're supporting certainly privatization of water and corporate control of water, and Why? Because you're too lazy to fill up your own water bottle at home? I mean, that's something that, you know, I think that's pathetic, actually.
Yeah. But on the road, I meant more on a trip where you're kind of going. But I hear what you're saying. You could just fill up your bottle in the hotel sink.
Yeah.
and still be healthy.
Yeah. It's a lot healthier than the petroleum products that go into plastic production and the landfill that you're creating by buying plastic water bottles.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And that water was filled from some tap. Like
yeah.
99% of the time. One question I had, Jenny, was so the new nonprofit that you started, or it's what, a year and a half old? Or
yeah, nonprofit
like
about a year and a half old.
Yeah, how did you get that going? And if you could talk a little bit, let's see, about the project in Nicaragua with the single mothers and kids.
Yeah, so I've been working with a bunch of permaculture colleagues. We're mostly based out of the Pacific Northwest, but actually we're all over the world. And so we're an itinerant teaching team. Many people have farms. They're very busy from March through October, November. And then they wrap things up for the winter. We live up north. And then we have the winter to go work in the tropics, which we love to do. And so we teach design courses, and we charge our students anywhere from $1,000 to $1,400 to take a course with us. And it's a 2 to 3 week intensive, and you learn a lot, and you get networked into this incredible international group of people. And that's one way that we make money. We don't make a lot, but we do get to travel over the world and work on these projects. So I decided about a year and a half ago to start a nonprofit so that people could donate to our projects, because we're really doing some amazing work. One of the projects we're working on is we have a nursery in Port Townsend, a plant nursery, but we also have plant nurseries in Central America. Mm-hmm. So the vision was that we wanted to have a series of independently owned permaculture all-star plant nurseries that were networked through Central America and seed banks. And so one of my really fun jobs is I get to run around the Central American bioregion looking for the very best genetics. Wow. And then getting them across borders and into nurseries where we can then propagate them. So the phases of nursery development are concentration of plant material, propagation, and then dissemination out into the community. And that's actually an apt word, because you're actually disseminating, you're actually putting the seeds out into the community. And then we teach all the nursery skills that go along with that. Everything from seed collecting to nursery management to plant propagation, to irrigation systems, to how to collect seed and how to store seed. And then we're also doing a lot of private client work. So I get to go to private fruit collections, botanical gardens, and I get to go to
must be amazing.
Indigenous villages. And I get to, you know, and there's this thing when you're in this sort of, you know, food gathering, seed gathering mode, you'll eat a fruit and you'll look at your friend and you're like, oh my God, this is an incredibly delicious one. I have to have the seed. I have to know where it came from. And or you'll eat one and you'll go, oh, this one's not worth it. You know, you won't save the seed. So that's one project. We're working with an organic coffee cooperative down there. Mm-hmm. They have many, 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 many acres of land that borders onto a cloud forest that's being deforested rapidly for firewood, and iguanas are almost extinct, and the deer that are there are almost extinct, and they do still have monkeys, and they do still have a lot of things there. But so we help them do an extensive wildlife biological corridor, and then we're also helping them develop an establishing food forest, you know, multi-story, you know, production food forest. And it's just sort of caught on like wildfire, and people all over the village are putting in nurseries, and we hire people to collect seed, and we have some other foreigners that are buying land that want to do permaculture installations, and we're getting local people to grow plants at their own homes. My own project that I worked on this year was I raised a bunch of money to do a design course for single moms and kids of a hands-on intensive. And these are folks that are very marginalized, and in their own words, there's no support from the government, there's no support from their families, there's certainly no support from the community, they're single moms. How they got there, whether it was by choice or by force, that's not a question I ask, but they're very marginalized. They have very little opportunity to earn money, and they sometimes just get paid in rice, you know, and their health is poor, and they can't afford to send their kids to school. In Nicaragua, you have to have a uniform, a pair of shoes, a book bag, a notebook, and a notebook, and a pencil to go to school, and they can't afford them. Maybe one kid in the family of six can go to school. So we pick single moms also because they don't have a husband at home who's going to be mad at them if they're gone all day having this really cool experience and dinner's not on the table. There's a lot of domestic violence in Nicaragua too. So we went down and we worked with them for the whole last year. We got, you know, built compost systems at their house. We put a small nursery in at every house. We did workshops. We did how to build fuel-efficient stoves with chimneys. There's no chimney technology down there. People have a lot of respiratory problems from the smoke, et cetera, et cetera. So we went down and we designed the course with their help. And what did they want to learn? They all really wanted to learn about how to make medicine, how to do plant medicine. So we brought in a medicinal plant expert. We built a potable water filter, and they built them for each one, got to take one home for their own home. We did plant medicines. We did plant propagation every day. We taught people how to bake. There's no baking technology there. So we taught people how to make sourdough bread and ginger cookies and banana bread.
And they looked very happy in the slide.
They were so happy. They just so loved it. And I made a deal with them that we would fund building a wood-fired cob or mud oven if they would agree to plant 1,000 firewood trees a year, which they have already started to do. So that's been a great success. The kids had a great time. They did music and art and recycled paper. We learned how to make our own paper and patterns in nature, and they made puppets and did a puppet show for the whole team, and it was just really, really fun. So we're hoping to expand that program next year. We're looking for donations for that project. We've thought of expanding the program into actually building a restaurant with the women, so they would get all the building skills, build a restaurant, have a workshop space, and then be able to actually sell some of the, and have a store to sell some of their stuff. We also did some artisan crafts with them.
That's fantastic. So basically you are helping to empower these women to be self, not, or part of a community, but also be able to take care of themselves financially.
Yeah. Feed their kids, feed their families, have planting strategies. I work a lot with edible tropical leaves that are really rich in iron and other minerals.
An example of that? Because last night I had to ask my friend, I'm all, edible tropical, what was it? And he said, I think it's leaves.
Yeah, leaves. Yeah. Okay, so here we can grow salad. Mm-hmm. And I eat salad every day. You know, that's where I get a lot of my greens. I'm a vegetarian. I eat tons and tons of salad. And I grow a huge, varied salad. Salad doesn't really grow in the tropics. And a lot of foreigners go down there and they just fail miserably trying to grow. They have to have their greens.
Yeah. And I need my lettuce.
And what they have down there instead is in the tropics, we have these shrubs that grow that have delicious, nutritious leaves on them. And they're just, some of them you can eat raw and some of them you have to cook. Just like, you know, rhubarb, you're not going to eat it raw, you're going to cook it, right? So most of them grow by cuttings or by seed, and they're just super easy to grow, and they're very prolific. And so we plant hedges or, you know, all kinds of just, you know, big areas of edible tropical leaves, and they grow like crazy, and you can just harvest them and eat
them. That's great.
And, you know, when you have an area that's, you know, has tons of problems with anemia, you know, growing a plant that has tons of iron in it that you can just eat out of hand is a great thing to have.
That's wonderful. You know, we're running a little short on time. I wish our show was 2 hours long today, because I feel like we could keep talking. But I would love it if you would tell our listeners about your upcoming workshop and what's going to be happening there.
Okay, so tomorrow, Saturday, from 10 to 2, we're doing a workshop that's for free at the, I'm going to get the name wrong.
I have it here, okay. Actually. It's at Monta Vista Elementary School at the Orchard Garden, which is 730 North Hope Avenue, Santa Barbara. So if you're on State Street, you're going to take a right on the mountainside of Hope.
Yeah, and this is an orchard that was put in by a group called Common Vision. And they drive around in a veggie bus and teach people how to grow food as well.
We did a show about them. It was really good. Yeah.
So this is we're going to just go give that orchard some love, and we're going to learn some permaculture strategies and just have a fun community afternoon working with several other permaculture people from your town right here. Mm-hmm. And I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to spend the rest of the day today visiting several plant nurseries and gathering some plants for the nursery. The university here has given me a small budget to get plants for this project.
Oh, that's great.
And so please join us. And we're happy to take a donation of $5 to $10 towards the project, but bring gloves and a shovel and a sun hat and
you don't have to bring plants or anything. Yeah.
No, but if you have some cardboard, bring some cardboard. We need some of that.
For mulching,
yeah.
And so it's going to be planting fruit tree guilds, and that is from 10 to 2, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, yep. At Monta Vista Elementary School. And if you have any questions about that workshop, which is tomorrow, you can call Margie Bushman at 805-962-2571. That's 962-2571. And that's Margie at santabarbarapermaculture.org if you want to email her.
Yeah, and if you want to learn more about our organization, you can go to permaculturenow.com, not permaculture later.
Permaculture Now. And your website, it's a really nice website too.
Thanks.
Yeah, very easy to read and great photos. And Jenny, I was wondering if you have any closing remarks. And also last night you read a saying or a statement in Spanish and then in English. And I just thought that was really beautiful. And if you'd like to repeat that, that would be great.
Yeah. My closing comments are that, permaculture is an all-inclusive movement. We need everybody. We need bankers. We need scientists. We need passionate people who are ready to step up and make some changes in their lives in a way that's moving us, as I said before, as a human family into a sustainable future. And there's all different ways you can enter into this movement, and it's an invitation. And as one of my, person I heard recently said, here we have the green wave and the rising green tide, and is that going to lift all boats, or is it just going to lift people who are privileged? And diversity is strength, and complex society is resilient. And so I encourage you to reach out to your brothers and sisters across cultural, racial, and class lines in this movement, as we do. We work with people who are highly educated and people who are illiterate. We work with people who are in all different walks of life.
Well, it's interesting. I was at the Alt Build in Santa Monica about a month ago, which is an alternative building expo, and someone had a new book out, a little booklet, and it was supposedly everything green in Los Angeles. And there was a map in the booklet of all these different zones, four zones in LA, and each zone there was a special section in the book, the green restaurants, the green gardens, everything green. Mm. And I noticed off to the side in LA, in South Central LA, nothing, no zone. It didn't even qualify as a zone. And that's when I had that same thought you did, like, wow, there could be more gardens there than in Santa Monica and North Hollywood. But it was very interesting how it was just totally left out.
Yeah, well, mapping is critical. Being put on the map or being wiped off the map is pretty, it brings up lots of images. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I had to have it written in Spanish in front of me. In English, it is, plant a seed and the ancestors speak through you. Plant a seed and you become the ancestors of future generations.
I love that. Thank you so much, Jenny.
Yeah,
and
you're welcome.
If you could give your contact information one more time.
Okay, so my name's Jenny Pell. I'm the founder of the Wilder Institute, Next Generation Permaculture. And our website is www.permaculturenow.com. And I hope to meet you on some of our design courses.
Yeah, thank you so much. And we're going to close with a song by Kate Halehi Rochelle. And we'll be back next week, Friday at 9 a.m. Thanks for tuning in to Sustainable World.